Welcome back. We're in chapter 4, the sacrifice, the triune path, and the Lord of the sacrifice. We're at the first breakpoint. Sri Aurobindo has come to the section in his analysis of the Gita, as presented here, where he'll begin to bring the triple path together into one fused whole. And you'll note, interestingly, that the Gita will proceed from works to knowledge, finally to devotion. Here at the back end of this section, we'll see that Sri Aurobindo, in a sense, has reversed that order. So, this, in short, is the demand made on us, that we should turn our whole life into a conscious sacrifice. This goes to the 9th chapter of the Gita, 27th shloka. Tat kurishva mad arpanam. That do as an offering to me. And what is the that? Whatever you do. Any moment that your attention is engaged in work, and which moment is that not, can be made an active offering, a consecration to the divine. Remember that the Gita is at this point in the history of Indian spirituality, beginning to look at work not simply as being the karma that goes into the Vedic sacrifice, but that everything can be regarded as sacrifice if it is intentional. The Buddha reinterprets karma as being meaningful and as something that we enjoin upon ourselves insofar as we intentionally do work. He did not think that works unintentionally done had karmic fruit, but it's what you intended to do that brings to you the lesson of the action that you did. Krishna, in presenting to Arjuna the idea of action that can be made divine, further expands that, not simply as a means of getting free from the fruit of the action, but as a means of being free in the action, so that one is not pulled away from the world into a life of renunciation, but rather renouncing the fruits of the action, one fully engages in life. It's a very different teaching. It is a teaching bordering on the integrality that Sri Aurobindo would much later introduce to India and the world. Every moment and every movement of our being is to be resolved into a continuous and a devoted self-giving to the eternal. All our actions, not less the smallest and most ordinary and trifling than the greatest and most uncommon and noble, must be performed as consecrated acts. But again, consecration, a word he chooses carefully here, consecrate, to make sacred, to make whole, to bring together. Smallest and most ordinary and trifling. We go back to the previous verse, 9:26 in the Gita. Patram pushpam palam toyam. Leaf, flower, fruit, water. Even these simple things can be offered, and I accept them. Krishna, speaking as the Parapurusha, the Supreme Person, says, what you offer to me sincerely, if you come to me in knowledge, if in perceiving me to be the recipient of all your work, you intentionally, honestly, fully offer that to me, I accept it, even if it seems trite, even if it seems mundane. It's a true offering. True, true in consciousness, true in self-giving. And he says, I receive it. Our individualized nature must live in the single consciousness of an inner and outer movement dedicated to something that is beyond us and greater than our ego. This is 9:34, where he says, become my-minded, my lover and adorer, a sacrificer to me. No matter what the gift or to whom it is presented by us, there must be a consciousness in the act that we are presenting it to the one divine being in all beings. Our commonest or most grossly material actions must assume this sublimated character. When we eat, we should be conscious that we are giving our food to that presence in us. It must be a sacred offering in a temple, and the sense of a mere physical need or self-gratification must pass away from us. Now, if you were a member of the Sri Aurobindo ashram decades and decades ago, you'll remember that it was common for people to go within before taking their food. It may be that some were saying a simple prayer, I give this food to you. But others had the inner experience of making an actual offering, a giving of the food representing a giving of the self, and in offering it to the divine, did not feel the act of offering was complete until they felt the divine accepted. When they felt that the food was accepted, then they would eat. You'll also remember that the mother had her soup ceremony in the early years of the ashram, later discontinued, in which she would make the soup and give it to each person. And sometimes she concentrated on the inner transference of consciousness through the fluid into the person. So it was not something that was done quickly. It was an actual empowerment ceremony. She was empowering the recipient with the force of her own conscious being. Such it is when we make the offering, when we sit down in front of a plate of food and we're going to take it, that we can turn that into an occasion in which we renew the sense of giving. We regain the rhythm. If we've lost it during the day, we can use the mealtime as an opportunity to restore. Just as when, in the midst of the day's activities, you find that you've lost your concentration, take a pause, go within, reestablish that connection, and proceed with the work again. Our commonest or most grossly material actions must assume this sublimated character. When we eat, we should be conscious that we are giving our food to that presence in us. It must be a sacred offering in a temple, and the sense of a mere physical need or self-gratification must pass away from us. In any great labor, in any high discipline, in any difficult or noble enterprise, whether undertaken for ourselves, for others, or for the race, it will no longer be possible to stop short at the idea of the race, of ourselves, or of others. The thing we are doing must be consciously offered as a sacrifice of works, not to these, but either through them or directly to the one Godhead. The divine inhabitant who was hidden by these figures must be no longer hidden, but ever present to our soul, our mind, our sense. The workings and results of our acts must be put in the hands of that one in the feeling that that presence is the infinite and most high, by whom alone our labor and our aspiration are possible. And there are several verses in the Gita which suggest this, 435, 629, 915. For in his being, all takes place. For him, all labor and aspiration are taken from us by nature and offered on his altar. Even in those things in which nature is herself very plainly the worker, and we only the witnesses of her working and its containers and supporters, there should be the same constant memory and insistent consciousness of a work and of its divine master. Our very inspiration and respiration, our very heartbeats can and must be made conscious in us as the living rhythm of the universal sacrifice. It is clear that a conception of this kind and its effective practice must carry in them three results that are of a central importance for our spiritual ideal. It is evident to begin with that even if such a discipline is begun without devotion, it leads straight and inevitably towards the highest devotion possible. For it must deepen naturally into a completest adoration imaginable, the most profound God love. There is bound up with it a growing sense of the divine in all beings, of the divine in all things, a deepening communion with the divine in all our thought, will, and action, and at every moment of our lives, a more and more moved consecration to the divine of the totality of our being. Now, these implications of the yoga of works are also of the very essence of an integral and absolute bhakti. The seeker who puts them into a living practice makes in himself continually a constant, active, and effective representation of the very spirit of self-devotion, and it is inevitable that out of it there should emerge the most engrossing worship of the highest to whom is given this service. An absorbing love for the divine presence to whom he feels an always more intimate closeness grows upon the consecrated worker, and with it is born, or in it is contained, a universal love too for all these beings, living forms and creatures that are habitations of the divine. Not the brief, restless, grasping emotions of division, but the settled, selfless love that is the deeper vibration of oneness. In all, the seeker begins to meet the one object of his adoration and service. The way of works turns by this road of sacrifice to meet the path of devotion. It can be itself a devotion as complete, as absorbing, as integral as any the desire of the heart can ask for, or the passion of the mind can imagine. So that about love, chapter 12, especially the 6th and 7th shloka. Next, the practice of this yoga demands a constant inward remembrance of the one central liberating knowledge and a constant active externalizing of it in works comes in too to intensify the remembrance. In all is the one self. The one divine is all. All are in the divine. All are the divine. And there is nothing else in the universe. This thought or this faith is the whole background until it becomes the whole substance of the consciousness of the worker. So here we're in the section on knowledge, and of course chapters 7 to 9 are titled that, but also read first chapters 4 through 6, especially 6, 29 through 31, which we mentioned last time. A memory, a self-dynamizing meditation of this kind, must and does in its end turn into a profound and uninterrupted vision and a vivid and all-embracing consciousness of that which we so powerfully remember or on which we so constantly meditate. That is chapter 8, shloka 22. That supreme purusha, parapurusha, is attainable by a bhakti which turns to him alone, in whom all beings exist, and by whom all this is pervaded. Back to the synthesis. For it compels a constant reference at each moment to the origin of all being and will and action, and there is at once an embracing and exceeding of all particular forms and appearances in that which is their cause and upholder. This way cannot go to its end without a seeing vivid and vital, as concrete in its way as physical sight of the works of the universal spirit everywhere. On its summits, it rises into a constant living and thinking and willing and acting in the presence of the supramental, the transcendent. Whatever we see and hear, whatever we touch and sense, all of which we are conscious, has to be known and felt by us as that which we worship and serve. All has to be turned into an image of the divinity, perceived as a dwelling place of his Godhead, enveloped with the eternal omnipresence. In its close, if not long before it, this way of works turns by communion with the divine presence, will, and force into a way of knowledge more complete and integral than any the mere creature intelligence can construct or the search of the intellect can discover. So first love, then knowledge, and now. Lastly, the practice of this yoga. Lastly, the practice of this yoga of sacrifice compels us to renounce all the inner supports of egoism, casting them out of our mind and will and actions, and to eliminate its seed, its presence, and influence out of our nature. All must be done for the divine. All must be directed towards the divine. Nothing must be attempted for ourselves as a separate existence. Nothing done for others. Whether neighbors, friends, family, country, or mankind, or other creatures, merely because they are connected with our personal life and thought and sentiment, or because the ego takes a preferential interest in their welfare. In this way of doing and seeing, all works and all life become only a daily dynamic worship and service of the divine in the unbounded temple of his own vast cosmic existence. So his Gospel of Works, Krishna's Gospel of Works, began in the second chapter, read the 71st shloka, continue in chapter 3, shloka 30, and then in chapter 12, 13, and 14. Here is what chapter 3, shloka 30 says, in part, giving up your works to me. With your consciousness founded in the self, free from desire and ego. Several yogas come together there. First, the transference of the works and all the fruit of the works to the divine is an act of love. That's bhakti yoga. But it's done actively, dynamically, so it's also karma yoga. Your consciousness founded in the self, that's the yoga of knowledge. That's becoming free of egoism, living in the felt unity of all beings in the one. And then free from desire and ego, which means no longer part of the old historical limited self that you were at the beginning of this path, but now you've outgrown it. You've outgrown that placement in this limited body and ego mind. You're not driven by desire. Instead, you feel the pull of the divine will. You feel the helping energy descending from above, and your energies are transfigured by that. And so your work becomes true and selfless, and again, generates no karma, no lesson that you have to learn later because of the work that you did and grasped at. So we continue. Life becomes more and more the sacrifice of the eternal in the individual, constantly self-offered to the eternal transcendence. It is offered in the wide sacrificial ground of the field of the eternal cosmic spirit, and the force too that offers it is the eternal force, the omnipresent mother. Therefore, in this way, a way of union and communion by acts, and by the spirit and knowledge in the act, as complete, as integral, as any our Godward will can hope for, or our soul's strength execute. So, the individual, awakened to the universal and expressly transferring all to the transcendent, to the Purushottama, the Parapurusha. It has all the power of a way of works, integral and absolute. But because of its law of sacrifice and self-giving to the divine self and master, it is accompanied on its one side by the whole power of the path of love, and on the other by the whole power of the path of knowledge. At its end, all these three divine powers work together, fused, united, completed, perfected by each other. And this is hinted at in the Gita, in the 9th chapter, 34th shloka, and again at the end of the Gita, the 18th chapter, the 65th shloka. They say essentially the same thing in the first part of the shloka and then close with a somewhat different thing. So it says, I haven't written this too small to see. Man mana bhava madbhukto madhyaji mam namaskuru mam evaishyasi tvaivam atmanam mat parayanaha. My tiny mind, my tiny hand. It says in English, become my-minded, my lover and adorer, a sacrificer to me. Bow yourself to me. United in the self with me, you shall come to me. With me, you will receive your supreme goal. It differs in the 18th chapter only by saying this. This truth I promise to you, for you are dear, priya, to me. So I think that is another natural breaking point in the text. We'll stop there. And I have rather a long passage tonight to read to you from Savitri, if you'll permit me. This is in Book 7. This is in the Book of Yoga, Canto 6, Nirvana and the All-Negating Absolute. This is page 547. Yet something was there behind the fading scene. Wherever she turned, at whatsoever she looked, it was perceived, yet hid from mind and sight. The one only real shut itself from space and stood aloof from the idea of time. Its truth escaped from shape and line and hue. All else grew unsubstantial, self-annulled. This only everlasting seemed and true, yet nowhere dwelt. It was outside the hours. This only could justify the labor of sight, but sight could not define for it a form. This only could appease the unsatisfied ear, but hearing listened in vain for a missing sound. This answered not the sense, called not to mind. It met her as the uncaught, inaudible voice that speaks forever from the unknowable. It met her like an omnipresent point, pure of dimensions, unfixed, invisible, the single oneness of its multiplied beat, accentuating its soul eternity. It faced her as some vast naught's immensity, an endless no to all that seems to be, an endless yes to things ever unconceived, and all that is unimagined and unthought, an eternal zero or untotaled aught, a spaceless and a placeless infinite. Yet eternity and infinity seemed but words vainly affixed by mind's incompetence to its stupendous lone reality. The world is but a spark burst from its light, all moments flashes from its timelessness, all objects glimmerings of the bodiless that disappear from mind when that is seen. It held, as if a shield before its face, a consciousness that saw without a seer, the truth where knowledge is not, nor knower, nor known, the love enamored of its own delight, in which the lover is not, nor the beloved, bringing their personal passion into the vast, the force omnipotent in quietude, the bliss that none can ever hope to taste. It canceled the convincing cheat of self. A truth in nothingness was its mighty clue. If all existence could renounce to be, and being take refuge in non-being's arms, and non-being could strike out its ciphered round, some luster of that reality might appear. A formless liberation came on her. Once sepulchred alive in brain and flesh, she had risen up from body, mind, and life. She was no more a person in a world. She had escaped into infinity. What once had been herself had disappeared. There was no frame of things, no figure of soul. A refugee from the domain of sense, evading the necessity of thought, delivered from knowledge and from ignorance, and rescued from the true and the untrue, she shared the superconscient's high retreat beyond the self-born word, the nude idea, the first bare, solid ground of consciousness. Beings were not there. Existence had no place. There was no temptation of the joy to be. Unutterably effaced, no one and no, a vanishing vestige like a violet trace, a faint record merely of a self now past, she was a point in the unknowable. Only some last annulment now remained, annihilation's vague, indefinable step. A memory of being still was there and kept her separate from nothingness. She was in that, but still became not that. This shadow of herself, so close to naught, could be again self's point d'appui to live, return out of the inconceivable, and be what some mysterious vast might choose, even as the unknowable decreed. She might be naught, or new become the all, or, if the omnipotent nihil took a shape, emerge as someone and redeem the world. Even she might learn what the mystic cipher held, this seeming exit or closed end of all could be a blind, tenebrous passage screened from sight. Her state, the eclipsing shell of a darkened sun on its secret way to the ineffable. Even now, her splendid being might flame back. Out of the silence and the nullity, a gleaming portion of the all-wonderful, a power of some all-affirming absolute, a shining mirror of the eternal truth, to show to the one and all its manifest face, to the souls of men their deep identity. Or she might wake into God's quietude beyond the cosmic day and cosmic night, and rest appeased in his white eternity. But this was now unreal or remote, or covered in the mystic fathomless blank. In infinite nothingness was the ultimate sign, or else the real was the unknowable. A lonely absolute negated all. It effaced the ignorant world from its solitude and drowned the soul in its everlasting peace. End of Canto 6. So. Namaste. Jai Ma.